Hello, and welcome to episode 90 of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I'm Nick Zoutra. On today's podcast, I am pleased to welcome Dr. Jonathan Fuller, Assistant Professor in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Pittsburgh. John draws on his dual training in philosophy and in medicine to answer some of the fundamental questions in science and healthcare, including questions about the nature of contemporary disease, evidence and reasoning in healthcare, and theory and methods in epidemiology and medical science. He believes that philosophy can benefit science as well as healthcare education and practice. John's research currently has two strands, disease and biomedicine, and epidemiology and evidence-based medicine. He studied the metaphysics, classification, and epidemiological modeling of diseases. He's also done research on causal inference, external validity, meta-research, and the relationship between population data and individuals in clinical research and epidemiology. John is currently working on an NIH-NLM-funded book project, tentatively titled The New Modern Medicine, that analyzes distinctive problems in scientific medicine around the turn of the 21st century. And thus, without further ado, let's bring in John. Dr. Jonathan Fuller, welcome to the Sci-Fi Podcast. How are you this Wednesday morning?
I'm doing very well, Nick. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's good to see you. I know we're nearby one another. We're calling each other from University of Pittsburgh. Are you home here in Pittsburgh now?
Yes, I'm at home, and Pittsburgh feels like home now. It's been a few years since I've been here, over three. But I still refer to Toronto, where I grew up, as home when I'm talking to people. So I need to get adjusted to referring to Pittsburgh as at least a second home.
Makes sense. So you grew up, so growing up in Toronto, and Toronto's, I mean, not too far away from Pittsburgh, is it? You can kind of just hop over. It's a relatively short drive. I know we have a fellow lecturer from Toronto as well, Austin Dew.
That's right.
Who's joined us. And, I'm sure it takes some adjusting, but, hopefully you'll be soon to call Pittsburgh at least a second home. What have you been up to this semester so far?
Well, this semester I am on leave from teaching to finish up a book project and, also just get started on some other research projects. So it's a nice kind of time to focus and catch up on research, although I do miss being in the classroom. I also had last semester off, so it's been a year since I was teaching, and I lose track a bit of what the grad students are doing, and so I am looking forward to getting back to doing that sometime in the near future.
Right. So you're currently in your third year here as assistant professor in the History and Philosophy of Science department at Pitt. And so, you've been teaching up to this point. You've been teaching courses in philosophy of bioethics, philosophy of medicine, things like that.
Yes, we have a conceptual foundations of medicine certificate in the undergraduate program, and that draws hundreds of students. I think over 600 students enrolled right now, mostly from science, who want to supplement their training, their education in health science or whatever area of science they're doing, with some work in the humanities. And it's a hugely popular program. The courses are always over enrolled, and it gives me an opportunity to teach lots and lots of philosophy of medicine and bioethics, and not just me, you and other lecturers and other faculty here as well. So that's, those courses are a huge part of our undergraduate teaching. And at the graduate level, I teach philosophy of medicine, philosophy of psychiatry, history of medicine, other courses in philosophy of science as well. But I think this undergraduate conceptual foundation certificate is quite unique. And it's an opportunity to reach undergrads who might not otherwise get exposure to philosophy of science and philosophy of medicine.
I agree. Yeah, and as you mentioned, having the experience this term to teach some of those courses, the morality of medicine course in particular. Yeah, the students, the science students in the sciences, pre-medical fields, they love it. They really enjoy the courses. They are many will take it as a requirement, but many will seek it outside of the discipline just because they find it fascinating and it's different from their traditional science courses what they have to take in order to graduate. So I think it's a really unique field, and from my learning about it, I think it's been around for quite some time, which makes the department very unique in that regard. And I'm not sure exactly how long, at least something like 15, 20 years or something like that, but it's possible that it's been around for even longer. So I think that's a really unique setup that University of Pittsburgh's department has. And it could be an interesting model, I think, to see for other departments, like setting up some connections. I know I've known of other departments to do this kind of a thing with human biology and other things, but I think Pittsburgh is for the most part, it's done it the longest and has really gotten the I've just never seen so many students so eager to sign up is my experience. So
I believe it was started in the 1980s by Ken Schaffner. So Ken Schaffner, philosopher of science, who at some point, I believe in the 1970s, decided to do his MD at Pitt while he was a professor in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science. And of the many initiatives that he started here, one of which was the certificate and the two courses in philosophy of science and philosophy of medicine and bioethics that survive today. So it's been going on for quite some time. And it's interesting to think about, the course, if you were could look back at past syllabi from 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, you might get a sense of what's changed in philosophy of medicine and bioethics, what topics have come and gone. You certainly would get a sense of the different ways that people teach and the different media they use. Of course, Ken used to use overhead transparencies. Now we use PowerPoints. 10 years from now, we'll just be lecturing in the metaverse.
Right.
So I think, it's interesting that these courses that have been around for a while, if you could look back, use them as a time capsule, you might be able to see, you might get a partial lens into how these fields and teaching in general and philosophy of science has changed.
Yeah, I could see like a paper out of that, something like a history of pedagogy or something like that that explores. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just especially when you have it's just not so often that you have like a course or a sequence like this that has stood the test of that it warrants like historical analysis or exploration. People like teaching different things. Courses will change, especially as the departments change. But there's the consistency, especially with the department, is really interesting. So yeah, no, that would be interesting to explore. Well, I'm eager to learn more about you, your research, also your familiarity with Ken Schaffner yourself, having a background in medicine and as a philosopher of science. So that's something that doesn't come across too often. So let's go ahead and get into it. So tell us, John, where'd you grow up? Well, we know this. You're from Toronto. Is that right?
Okay. I grew up in Toronto, yep. And I spent more years in Toronto than anywhere else. So when I was going through higher education, I spent 4 years at Western University in London, Ontario for my undergrad. But then I quickly went back to Toronto for another 9 years when I was doing an MD and a PhD. And except for short stints in London, UK, and San Diego, I continued in Toronto for most of my life and then have been in Pittsburgh for the last just over 3 years.
Great. So growing up, I mean, was what kind of things were you interested in? Was sciencey things, other things outside of completely unrelated to philosophy or medicine? What does somebody what is it like to grow up in Toronto?
Well, I grew up in a suburb of Toronto, the West End, named Etobicoke. And so I think it's a bit different than growing up perhaps in downtown Toronto, where you are a stone's throw from the CN Tower and, what used to be called the Sky Dome, where the Toronto Blue Jays play. But, when I was growing up, my first love, my first interest, I guess you could say academically, was writing. I loved reading and I liked creative writing. And I sort of thought that I would be a writer one day, maybe a novelist. And then my second love was pretty much anything that you could learn in school. So in high school, I kind of loved everything from English to science and philosophy. Even among the sciences, you know, I didn't discriminate among physics, biology, chemistry, mathematics. I loved it all. So I was really, bookish, as you would imagine. And, still to this day, I kind of have a wide interest in lots of different topics, and that has perhaps influenced the path that I've taken. You know, I've done lots of different education and dipped my toes in different kinds of fields. And that probably reflects partly the fact that my academic interests are so diverse. So I was in high school taking all these courses. Biology among the sciences was the one I was most interested in. And my father, of course, is a general practitioner physician. So I was more exposed to medicine than any other career field. For a couple of summers, I worked for him in his office as his receptionist while his full-time receptionist was on summer holiday. And so I got to see what his day-to-day life was like. And I thought, this is really interesting. I mean, he spends his days basically talking with people and trying to help them sort out their problems. And I could think of a heck of a lot worse ways to be spending your time during the day. So, and plus my interest in science and biology, combined with the thought of, being able to spend your day talking with people and helping sort out their problems, really drew me to medicine. So I thought that I wanted to be a doctor. I put the kind of idea of being a writer on the side. And when I applied to undergraduate programs, I applied to science programs, and that's what I did at Western. I did a degree in medical science focusing on physiology. And my plan for a while was to go to medical school and become a doctor.
Okay. So at Western, focusing in physiology. So that's kind of a common story. I know medicine, the paths of medicine can be certainly influenced by those who you see, family members, a parent or a, grandparent or something like that get involved. What was that like in terms of focusing in terms of medicine? Did you have like a specialty you, could foresee doing, or, was that on the radar yet?
Well, while I was at Western, I decided to do some research as well during one summer, and also I did an honors thesis that involved research, and that research was focused on neuroscience. One project was in reward system, that was basic science involving animals and behavioral models in rats, as well as molecular work. And another project was in neural stem cells. And so, I was really interested in neuroscience above all else in medical science. And so maybe I thought I might become a neurologist or something like this. But while I was doing all this scientific research, I also kind of fell in love with aspects of research, of science, of doing science itself. This continued the pattern of kind of being interested and attracted to everything that I was learning about and trying. I also did some philosophy, some history of medicine, loved that. So the problem, if any, was that I just kind of liked everything that I encountered. And so I decided, this research thing is something that I really like. So why don't I try to do both, to train in medicine and practice as a clinician, but also to do science research. And, I was exposed to some people who had gone on to do MD, PhD programs. There were a few of these in Canada and many, many in the States. And so I applied to some programs to do an MD, PhD, where my intention was to do a PhD in science and probably in neuroscience. Two of my letter writers were the supervisors who'd supervised my work on the reward system and on neural stem cells. And then the third letter was written by somebody, a historian of medicine at Western named Paul Potter, who had supervised a little research project in history of medicine. And so those were my three letter writers. I applied to Western and to the University of Toronto to do an MD PhD. I ended up accepting an offer from Toronto. And, you know, my intention and what I told the large panel of 10 people who'd interviewed me for that, for the Toronto position, was I would, you know, be a clinician scientist, and my science would be in my scientific research would probably be in neuroscience. So, you know, when I had gotten to that stage of my life, still focusing on science and still thinking that I was going to be a doctor and maybe now also a scientist. So we're still, quite a big leap away from where I ended up.
Of course. Okay. Well, yes. I mean, this is a simple, you know, there's definitely the path of the those who are interested in science, but like writing too. I see a lot of similarities there. So, but this is might be the first, not the first, I would say, but where you get, so you, you are accepted into a PhD program in neuroscience. Is that right?
Well, and here's the kind of here's the twist that made it possible for me to do philosophy of science and philosophy of medicine. So when you're accepted into this particular program in Toronto, you don't have to commit to working with a particular supervisor or even a particular PhD program at the university. You're just admitted to this MD-PhD stream.
Right.
And you typically start off in medical school within this particular program, Toronto, and then you will apply to a PhD program, often in your first year of medical school, and find a supervisor. And so they had admitted me to do an MD-PhD, but they hadn't admitted me to do a PhD in neuroscience, basic science, or even science. And anyway, my intention was to do neuroscience at the time. Then something happened. So I was, and I can't remember how or why, but I was just browsing around different web pages, the University of Toronto, and I was exploring the Institute for the History of Philosophy of Science and Technology, Toronto's HPS program. And, you know, I've been interested in philosophy since high school and done a bit in my undergrad, but I had never really, I never really was that familiar with HPS as a subdiscipline within philosophy of science. So I looked at all the people that were affiliated with the Institute, including the affiliated faculty. And one person who I landed on was Ross Upshur, who is a clinician at the University of Toronto in public health, bioethics, and in philosophy of medicine. And I'd never heard of philosophy of medicine before. Of course, I'd heard of bioethics. People outside of philosophy are familiar with bioethics, a discipline that investigates ethical issues that arise in healthcare and research. Medical students do some work and some coursework and training in bioethics. It's a very established and well-known discipline. But this idea that there could be something else called philosophy of medicine wasn't something that ever crossed my radar. So I decided to set up a meeting to meet with Ross Upshur. And at this time, he was the director of the Joint Center for Bioethics at the University of Toronto. And he told me all about philosophy of medicine and his own path and his interest in this topic. And I remember one particular, I'd read a couple of his papers before going into this meeting. And one of the papers in particular had really captured my interest. And this was a paper where he talked about some of the challenges in evidence-based medicine for the care of patients that he often saw in his practice who were older patients with multiple chronic diseases who were on multiple long-term medications. These patients who were complex in their health status and also in their patient management, and for whom it didn't quite seem like we had the ideal evidence to guide their care. Oftentimes clinical trials would exclude patients who have different diseases than the one being studied. Sometimes older patients would be excluded. And oftentimes patients on multiple other medications would be excluded. You want to make sure that there aren't any drug interactions that might harm patients and also make it difficult to analyze the results. And, there used to be a kind of thinking that simpler trial populations would at least allow you to establish the so-called efficacy of a treatment, how well it might work in, you might say, an ideal circumstances. But then what do you do when you are a clinician like Ross, who has a practice population with lots of older patients who are unlike the people that were enrolled in these trials? And so he described the problem this way. He said that there are these inferential gaps between evidence or research in medicine and the real-world patients that clinicians were caring for. And so in other words, he put this in an epistemic way. He described it as a kind of logical or inferential problem. And as somebody who still was very fascinated and in love with science, this led me to see that there were these problems in philosophy, science, and medicine that were essentially scientific problems, but also apparently philosophical problems as well. And one person who had done a lot of work in philosophy and thinking about inferences from medical evidence was the philosopher of science of many decades, Nancy Cartwright. Who had done some work on causal inference in trials and who had published lots of articles arguing that we need to think more carefully about how we actually close this so-called inferential gap that Ross had identified between trial population. So this problem, which has been called the problem of extrapolation, was kind of the first one in philosophy of science and medicine that really got me hooked almost immediately. And the idea that I could be doing what was essentially, I thought, science, but also philosophy at the same time was really what attracted me to start thinking now about doing a PhD in philosophy of medicine and philosophy of science. So it really wasn't until I was in this program, already, had already signed the papers and was already admitted and in medical school, that I came across philosophy of medicine and as an area of philosophy of science and decided to try it out. So I started by doing a summer project with Ross. And after a few months of doing that, I decided that it was more my style than pipetting in a lab, and I made what was probably an unwarranted leap of faith and decided to do a PhD in philosophy of medicine after having not really spent that much time doing philosophical research and work and or even really doing that much philosophy coursework. I guess sometimes when you know that you love something, You just take that leap. Yeah. You just kind of know that it's right for you, and it was obviously the best decision that I've ever made.
Well, thank you for that story. I think it is certainly unique. This is the this is definitely the first experience that in this particular order or this particular way. It rings true in terms of how many of us find this field of being able to do a little bit of both, meeting mutual interests. A few things I've heard is just, I'm really happy to hear that Toronto was so supportive of this path, as well as your advisor, during the time. I think that's something that not everyone gets to experience. And the thought that, a program like this would be, encouraging and this kind of area is understanding of that, I don't want to say eclectic, but just like unique, positioning of sorts is really fascinating. I'm sure it was probably interesting to meet with other people in the MD PhD program. They're like, are you doing what? Like, I'm what you're in, yeah. But maybe Toronto was like a thing for that, with Upshur and others. But I imagine, generally speaking, I imagine MD PhDs, right? Or like you're MD and then you're in whatever it is, biotech, or you're in, infectious diseases. Like the thought is, I'm going to do research in a medical center someday. I'm going to do, there's a little bit of folks who want to stay in the lab or something like that. But so I'm really happy to hear about this. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Toronto's program is, is often fairly described as a clinician scientist training program. And for most of its history, the MD PhD program, who wanted to broaden the scope and the diversity of different kinds of research that were represented. And definitely what he had in mind were things like health services research and other areas of health science research beyond basic bench science. Definitely philosophy of medicine wasn't on his radar.
Sure.
To be honest, I was a little bit of a Trojan horse, right? Because I was admitted to the program and they thought I was going to do neuroscience.
Right.
And then because they admit you to the program and they don't admit you to an area, you're able to kind of pivot at that point. And, you know, I think that to their credit, they were very open to the idea of me doing this area that they had never even heard of. But, you know, I do want to mention and put in the caveat that it's not entirely clear to me that if I'd showed up at this 10-person panel interview and said that I wanted to do philosophy of science and philosophy of medicine, that they would have admitted me for various reasons. One is, you might ask, is there really even a career path in this field for clinician investigators to do work in philosophy of science and medicine? We can get to that a bit later, whether the answer is yes or no. But, and the second is, you know, I really hadn't done that much research in philosophy of science at that point, any at all, to be honest. So I was probably ill-equipped to make that decision. And so, you know, as with many things in life, it's just a kind of confluence of circumstances that allowed me to kind of do this. But, you know, it is a kind of, there is a caution there for people who might be thinking, well, why don't I just jump into an MD PhD program and do philosophy of medicine and philosophy of science? I mean, different programs have different, they might have different views about these kind of things. In the States, there are programs where it's not uncommon for people to do history of medicine or medical anthropology. So there are definitely places and opportunities where you can do work in humanities. And I do know of a couple of people who are doing now or have done medicine or even have practiced medicine or done residency, who've later done a PhD in philosophy of science or medicine. So there are examples out there, but these joint training programs, they're obviously not awash with people who are doing philosophy for their PhD.
I appreciate that caveat, and I think that's something that should be encouraged, that especially in exploring the nature of what is appropriate, or what are the values of that program, and what kind of applicant they're looking for. Or, and yeah, it's just the nature of academics, as well as sometimes of once you're in, you can kind of, there are ways of working or shifting programs. And this happens in a PhD space as well, even if we're not talking about joint degrees. But no, that's really interesting. I mean, I've seen other kinds of programs, things like MD or like MD JDs or something like that, where you might start off at doing, you do your core, you focus on a core. Maybe it's, I think with that, it's like you start in medical school, then you do L1, and then you kind of go back and forth, things like that. So they figured out ways to do it. But yeah, no, this is, yeah, very unique path. So you mentioned something about, and this is very common for folks who come from a science background or and who, you know, have philosophical interests, but not a lot of formal disciplinary training in philosophy. So it was it in graduate school then when you kind of picked up this second, or when you decided to, find your way into philosophy in this way? How did you go about gaining some of that, disciplinary training?
Well, I think I did it in two ways. One is that, you know, I did all the usual graduate coursework in philosophy, mostly from the Institute for HBS at Toronto, and some courses from the philosophy department. So pretty quickly, after taking a bunch of graduate seminar courses in philosophy of science, you make up for any lack of, you know, knowledge of the field, and then some. I also surrounded myself with people, here's the other unique thing about my training. I mean, I surrounded myself with philosophers, but also with clinicians. So my advisory committee, my supervisor was Ross Upshur, who was both a philosopher and a clinician. Ayala Cooper, who is an internist, who does research in medical education, and who has, you know, background in the humanities and approaches medical education research from the methodologies and theories in the humanities. And then I added Paul Thompson, who is a philosopher of science at the Institute. So a really even mix of philosophers and clinicians among the group. And I spent most of my time, to be honest, not at the Institute, not in that building, but rather in the hospital, Toronto General Hospital, where I had a desk in the Wilson Center for Research in Health Professions Education. So I decided that philosophers were my people, but also I really liked, I wanted to stay connected to medicine while I was doing the PhD. I also envisioned my work as being, pretty engaged with medicine and medical research. So I felt like I fit in well with that community. So I ended up doing a concurrent research fellowship in medical education at the Wilson Center. And that's where my physical desk was located. So I actually spent more time hanging out with clinicians who were doing research in medical education and then, to be honest, philosophy graduate students throughout my training. And you know, that certainly had an interest in the way I approach things and the kinds of questions that I asked, and even the sense of my own identity. I mean, I did and probably still do think of myself as somebody who does medical research. It's just that the tools that I use are tools from philosophy of science. And hopefully that staying connected to medicine throughout my PhD helped keep the relevance of the work I was doing, helped keep it close enough to medical research in the clinic to be of interest and relevance. And so that kind of answers your question. I did kind of get that background in philosophy of science that I needed, but also I stayed pretty closely connected to medicine throughout the PhD. I also spent a couple of years abroad, I mentioned at the beginning. So I went to King's College London in the UK for a year.
Oh, nice.
Because I figured, because at the time they had their concepts of health and disease program, and King's was sort of perhaps the place for philosophy of medicine at the time in the, around the year 2013 to 2014 when I went. While I was there at King's, they announced a new program, the Sowerby Program in Philosophy and Medicine, which is growing strong to this day. And so that was a chance to spend time in an environment where they had a master's program in philosophy of medicine, and lots of people who were doing research in philosophy of medicine. And I got an opportunity to actually spend some time outside of Canada for the first time. I worked with most closely with David Papineau there, and that was a great experience. Spending hours on end fighting about causal inference in randomized trials.
Yeah,
and so that was also really formative for me. And it's often difficult to find the money or the ability to do these trips abroad during graduate school. But if you can do it, if you can visit somewhere else, I really highly, highly recommend it. Different people, different environments. It's really helpful at an early stage to kind of broaden your perspective and your horizons, and give you maybe additional tools just by virtue of working with different people who think a bit differently. So that was really great. Then shortly after that, I spent 6 months in at UC San Diego working with Nancy Cartwright. So those two experiences combined with exposure to all these clinicians and philosophers in Toronto, it really had a huge impact on my own thinking and inspired my own research. And so by the time that I had done this 6 months in San Diego in 2015, I was nearing the end of my dissertation at that point, which was looking at it was a bit unfocused. I was looking at both disease and evidence. I wanted to kind of do work that spanned the major areas of philosophy of medicine. So I was focused on the nature of chronic disease and multifactorial causation on the one hand, and evidence-based medicine and these inferences that I initially got attracted to on the other hand. Mm-hmm. That was sort of I kind of tried to tie a bow around and bring it all together in a dissertation and defended that in 2016 before going back and finishing medical school.
Right. Okay. I thank you for sharing also that, what I imagine is also a pretty unique, exposure to a number of different ideas. I've known of, being a visiting scholar is something that some PhD students do during their time, but it's not always a thing. It's not always encouraged. And I'm really happy to hear that you had the experiences that you did. I think it'd be good to see more programs, encourage that, so to speak, at least for a semester or a short period of time for folks, especially to gather some, training in the specific area in which they're looking to work.
Well, there's a story there. I mean, I was fortunate enough to get funding in both occasions. And the first, when I went to King's College London, I mean, it's very expensive living in London on a stipend paid for by the Canadian dollars. So I was fortunate enough to get what they called a fellowship, a 1-year research abroad fellowship. It was brand new, And it was funded by the Weston Foundation, which is started by the Westons, who are kind of a Canadian institution. They're this billionaire family who owns Loblaw and Shoppers Drug Mart, which are, if you're not in Canada, grocery and drugstore
chains. I'll take your word for it. Yeah, I'm sure I'll see it if I visit sometime.
when I won this award, they had a lunch with several members of the Weston family who I suppose played some role in choosing the winners from University of Toronto, people who were successful. And this is the closest I ever sat to a billionaire. So far, I sat next to him at a lunch, Galen Weston Sr., who was one of the founders of the company. Looking back on it, maybe I should have been like,
what did that feel like? Oh, wow. Yeah.
Shark Tank or Dragon's Den style pitched him an idea.
You got to create this philosophy of medicine institute where you hire lots of philosophers to do really cutting edge work, and we'll monetize it, and we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out.
Yeah. It was a big missed opportunity. No
darn.
I just kind of ate my salad or whatever it was and made small talk. I
don't blame him.
Talked about my research a little bit. Yeah.
Wow. So, okay, well, no, I mean, well, that's the other thing too. It's like getting these, it is one thing. It's nice to say, oh yeah, sure. Come, departments will be like, come visit. You're like, well, yeah, but kind of, just visiting requires, funding and requires something. So I'm glad this kind of scholarship exists. And I think I would hope that this kind of thing, right, not just the burden wouldn't be necessarily placed solely on the student to make sense of things or the postdoc researcher, even. That's often when it happens that we can create some sort of schemes to have this go. So what was it like though to go back then to finishing the PhD and then kind of returning to, I mean, at the same time though, you mentioned that you're kind of your people in some ways, it's philosophy, but as in many ways, clinicians, you're doing this kind of philosophy in medicine, if I might use those terms. What was it like returning back to finish your rotation, finish the MD?
Well, it was disorienting because, a PhD in philosophy is a world apart from medical school. The former gives you, especially in the latter years where you're writing your dissertation, there's just wide flexibility, mental and intellectual flexibility, how you structure your day, totally up to you. It's up to you whether or not you like get out of bed in the morning, really. There's nothing, often there might be nothing you have to do during that day other than write. I thrived under that in that kind of environment. By the time I had finished my PhD, I had a publication and maybe even one or two more accepted. I had presented at conferences and I felt like I was kind of a philosopher of medicine now. And I had a lot of research momentum. I was making strides in the field and meeting people and so I was someone in philosophy of science and medicine, and I liked that life. And then to go back to the bottom of the totem pole in medical school, where you have very little control over what you're doing, your schedule, the kinds of tasks you do in a week, was the polar opposite. And in many ways, it wasn't. I didn't love that kind of change of pace. I was still interested in what I was learning in medical school.
Right.
But I missed being an independent thinker and a researcher. Now I cheated at first because I went back to year two of medical school in Toronto, which like many places is still a pre-clerkship phase where you're doing mostly book learning with some clinical exposure. And so there remains a lot of flexibility there. And you could cram for exams for a few weeks, and then after that, you could take it easy, more or less, go to classes, but still have a lot of time to do other things. And so that's what I did. I was, alternated cramming for exams and then doing more philosophy research, finishing papers and doing revisions on papers. So I was still doing philosophy research. And so actually the first year when I was back in medical school, I was pretty happy still. I had it both ways, basically. I was doing medicine and I was doing philosophy. But that all changed when I went into the clerkship years, where you're rotating around different clinical sites and hospitals, and it's much busier. And there just isn't the time and the flexibility to do very much research at all. I tried to squeeze as much time to do that as I could, but it wasn't very much. And so, and I found myself a few times having difficulty falling asleep at night because I was thinking about a philosophical problem that you know, I didn't have time to think about during the day. And so my mind was like, well, you didn't give me any time to think about causation today. So now this is my time, baby. From 11 p.m. to 3 a.m., this is what I'm going to be doing. So, it sounds a bit facetious, but I literally did lay in bed at night, vexed by problems of like probability and causation. And then I showed up to clinic very tired the next day. And that, of course, let me know that I was really, really passionate about this philosophy stuff. And I wasn't going to be happy if I wasn't able to do it at the end of the day. And there were areas in medicine that I was really interested in. I liked, first of all, I liked general practice and the diversity of things you do and the people you see and the problems you handle. And then beyond that, I particularly liked neurology and psychiatry. And I strongly considered going into one of these areas, but in the end, I decided not to continue after finishing medical school and do a residency and further training for a couple of reasons. The first reason, and probably, you know, honestly, a very strong factor, was that I was burnt out after many years of training. And this is something to kind of keep in mind. I mean, you know, in the ideal decision context, you would just dispassionately weigh your future options and say, you know what, I'm going to spend another 5 years doing residency training, and then in a long-termist perspective, this would be the best thing for me. But no, I mean, I was very tired, I didn't want to spend any more of these sleepless nights thinking about philosophy when I was, and then having to show up to clinic the next day. I really didn't like, it didn't sit well with me not being able to do research during the busiest phases of my training. And that was only going to continue in residency, where you really are more responsible for patients and just continues to be very, very busy. So that definitely played a role, that at the time I didn't want to do more training. The other thing, the more kind of, intellectual set of reasons for wanting to go into philosophy was that one, I made the decision this way. I kind of said, well, what can I not live without? And I'd come to the conclusion that I couldn't live without doing research in philosophy of science and medicine. And then I probably could live without spending time in the clinic. I liked it for sure, but my instinct was that I could lead a happy life now in philosophy and not have too much regret about not doing medicine if it came to that. But I wasn't convinced that the opposite was true, that I could, that if I ended up just being a doctor and spending my day in the clinic, that I would be happy. And I think, had I never taken the blue pill of philosophy, there's another world in which I probably am a very happy clinician, never having been exposed to philosophy of science. I think it's a very rewarding lifestyle. But then getting that blue pill and stepping out of the matrix for a bit kind of showed me that this other part of life that now I can't live without. So so I decided that it was that trying to balance clinical medicine and philosophy research was still a very uncertain proposition. Maybe it could be done within bioethics or within public health or something like this, but the idea of being a clinician philosopher still wasn't a very established track. And so in 2019, when I was finishing medical school, I was looking at philosophy jobs, and there was this great looking position at in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at University of Pittsburgh. They were looking for somebody who might do one of a number of things, and one of the areas they were targeting in their search was philosophy of medicine. And there really aren't that many searches in which philosophy of medicine is a target within philosophy. So I was very fortunate that this job came up right at the time I was finishing medicine. And I talked to people about the reputation of the department, and I was familiar a bit with Pitt HBS. And it had this reputation of being a place in which not only were the students and the faculty very engaged with the science that they were studying itself. But oftentimes they'd actually come to the department having had a prior background in science, whether engineering or neuroscience or physics. And of course, I known Ken Schaffner's work and was aware that he'd done an MD. And so it just seemed like, well, you know, maybe these are my people. I mean, these people who are obviously very connected to the science that they're studying and who are willing to do engaged, integrated work, but also are asking fundamental questions in philosophy of science, which those are the questions that were keeping me up at night. And so I rightly, you know, saw that this would be a great opportunity for me. So rather than applying to residencies, I applied to this job at Pitt, and now here I am.
Well, wow. Thank you for that. No, thank you for the update. Pitt is very happy to have you, I'm sure. And no, it's really interesting to think, and I really like your decision-making process of how to, of the way, just a very practically pragmatic approach to deciding what, how to go about this. And yeah, so no, thank you for sharing that. Well, so why don't you tell us, a little bit about, so now you've had the opportunity, you brought us up to speed, but you've decided to, you can finally focus on the things that have been keeping you up at night. So what is one of these projects that you first got into, maybe like maybe one of your favorites, or perhaps the most intriguing to you, that things were keeping you up at night that you ended up working on, that you ended up seeing through to completion? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the biggest project that has occupied me for the last few years has been a book that is nearing completion.
Why don't we talk about this book?
Medicine and Science.
Fantastic. Yeah, so it's fantastic.
It's a book in philosophy of science and medicine. The tentative title is The New Modern Medicine. And it was inspired originally by some experiences back in Toronto while I was doing my training. So on the one hand, you know, when I was at Western doing physiology and medical science, I had the impression that medicine was really about the basic medical sciences and kind of using them to inform medical reasoning and decision making. So, you know, the clinicians were kind of like applied physiologists, applied basic scientists. They were learning about these basic sciences of medicine and then using that knowledge in order to help reason about disease and treatment. A very naive view about what medical reasoning was all about. But that was influenced by what were the so-called medical sciences that were on offer for studying in Western's basic medical sciences program. I mean, they did have biostatistics, but by and large, a lot of the sciences were laboratory sciences. And these were the sciences that really launched scientific medicine into a global institution 100 or more years ago. So the big breakthroughs in medical science and scientific medicine back then were the germ theory of disease, which is still the theory that we accept about how infectious diseases are caused, namely by microbes, and research in physiology, so-called experimental medicine or laboratory medicine, about endocrinology and biochemistry, and using that understanding to develop interventions. And this was kind of the vision of medical reasoning and medical science that I'd inherited. And a lot of the older work in history of medicine, which I'd been exposed to during undergrad, and then as I continued to read and do work in during my time in the MD-PhD program, was focused on these earlier periods in the history of medicine. And scientific medicine was all about the biological life sciences, so-called biomedicine, which is still an image of scientific medicine that shapes the way we think about it today in medicine and outside of medicine. But, you know, when I started to do medical school, and then when I started especially to do my research in philosophy of medicine, I realized that there was a whole other side of the picture. There was this movement called evidence-based medicine in the second half of the 1900s, in which it wasn't a biomedical laboratory sciences that were guiding reasoning. It was clinical epidemiology or statistical epidemiological science that might often black box details of the underlying mechanism of health and disease and just try to demonstrate empirically what works. And there's a tradition of this in medicine, but it's the dominant one in clinical reasoning right now. And, you know, now instead of just relying on the laboratory scientists to understand etiology of disease, the causes of disease, we rely largely on epidemiology as well. We learned that smoking causes lung cancer mostly through epidemiological research. And we learned about the causes of heart disease, the risk factors for heart disease through, you know, famous cohort studies. And this was something that was surprising to me. And I realized that this was kind of, in a way, the story of modern medicine today. It was a story of epidemiological science shaping medicine. And it wasn't a story that was told to me through my science education before that. In particular, there was a book that was published in 2011 that I'd read just as I was starting my graduate training, called The Making of Modern Medicine. And this is a fantastic book, a very short book, under 100 pages, written by the late historian Michael Bliss, a Toronto historian who spent the second part of his career as a historian looking at medicine. And in this book, he summarizes kind of his earlier work and three different projects that he'd written books about, which were smallpox epidemics in Montreal. And then a little bit later on, the kind of founding of modern American medical education at Johns Hopkins, where they really used a German model of science education in order to redesign the curriculum, and which then kind of expanded outward and revolutionized medical education across North America. And then the third episode that Michael Bliss talks about is the discovery of insulin at the University of Toronto. And in this kind of book, The Making of Modern Medicine, he kind of brings these together to kind of tell the story of how medicine became modern in a certain sense. And this is a popular narrative, a common narrative in medicine, but also in history of medicine, that it was science that transformed medicine and made it modern sometime in the 1800s or maybe early 1900s. And the sciences that did this were the sciences that gave us insulin, physiological research. So if modern medicine was defined by those kinds of sciences, then what about medicine today? What I came to call the new modern medicine, medicine of the turn of the 21st century, evidence-based medicine, and the medicine of chronic disease epidemiology. Another aspect to all this was the importance of risk and risk factors in medicine, a kind of statistical way of thinking about the aims of diagnosis and treatment. We want to find out not just what diseases you suffer from, but the diseases you're at risk of suffering from. And we don't just want to cure you. We want to prevent disease by lowering your risk of future events. So these different elements, risk and chronic and non-communicable diseases of multifactorial etiology, and the idea of using results from randomized clinical trials to directly inform care, these different kind of elements, these different vertices in a triangle form this picture of the new modern medicine that started developing in my head. And so I wanted to tell the story of what this medicine is and what its unique philosophical problems are. And I thought that I needed a book to do it. So I set out writing this book, The New Modern Medicine, and it investigates these different aspects that I've mentioned, the causation and nature of contemporary chronic and non-communicable diseases, including cancer, as well as the ways we reason from epidemiological evidence, and the concept of risk and how it and what it means, and how we get from populations to individuals by talking about risk. So these are the kind of different strands that I try to weave together in the book and give a kind of picture of scientific medicine today and what makes it different from scientific medicine 100 years ago, the kind of old modern medicine, you might say. And so if you want to call the old modern medicine laboratory medicine or physiological medicine, or experimental medicine, these are all terms that have been used by historians to kind of characterize it. So a name that I use to characterize this new modern medicine is epidemiological medicine, because while the old modern medicine, laboratory medicine, or experimental medicine, physiological medicine, terms that historians have used to describe it, was in some sense integrated with laboratory research, this medicine is especially integrated with epidemiological research. Some non-communicable disease epidemiology, the kinds of research that that allows you to identify risk factors for diseases like heart disease and cancer, as well as clinical epidemiology, which is the science that, you know, for instance, uses randomized clinical trials to figure out what works. And although it's of course not the case that biomedical research has gone away, in fact, funding has only increased over the decades, and it still plays an important part in medical epistemology and shaping our understanding of disease. I wanted to highlight the unique contribution of epidemiology to thinking about to medical thinking today, and to focus on the problems that are somewhat unique compared to problems in scientific medicine of the past. And so that's what the book is about.
Fantastic. Thank you for that overview. Could you share with us perhaps, so I know you mentioned things like risk and other reasoning, multifactorial causation or factors in informing etiology of disease or illness. But what are some of the, so for philosophers of medicine, what are some of the key issues or problems that you hope to focus in on the book, or if you could put them into questions, how would you describe them?
Yeah, sure. So, the book is kind of structured with different chapter level questions or problems. And so in one chapter, I look at theories of disease and ask, are there theories of disease in contemporary medicine? People are familiar with theories of the past, like humoral theory, Hippocratic theory of the four humors. But are there theories of medicine today, or are there just piecemeal explanations? And I answer that actually, yes, the history of scientific medicine has been greatly shaped by what one might want to call theories of disease. The germ theory was the best example 120 years ago. But today we do have a sort of theory of cancer, which some have called the somatic mutation theory, which one of its primary functions is really to shape or direct medical research into the causes of cancer. And so we might actually be able to talk about theories in this area of science.
Interesting.
Seemingly an old topic in philosophy of science. So we've gone on to talk more about models and other kinds of explanation in philosophy of science. But this is an area in which it might actually be useful to think about theories and what role they might still play in sciences like medicine, which at first glance are kind of motley sciences with lots of different models and explanations. And still there might be these kind of theories that are operating in the background. So that's just one chapter, one question. I also look at what it means for diseases to be multifactorial, whether some diseases have a universal cause, particularly infectious diseases, and whether this is really a fact about the world and about diseases, or whether there's in some sense a way in which we decide what diseases are multifactorial and which ones have a universal etiology. I develop an account of the nature of chronic disease and mental disorder using the literature on dispositions in metaphysics to help understand how it can be that people have these disorders that can persist throughout their lives often. And yet at certain times, they might not actually be manifesting overt clinical findings. In the case of mental disorders, this is quite striking because they're diagnosed exclusively on the basis, exclusively on the basis of behaviors and symptoms. And yet it is possible for at least some mental disorders for people to be completely in remission and not have any symptoms at a certain point in time, or to have their symptoms managed effectively by medication or therapy. And so we diagnose people as having these disorders using behaviors and symptoms. And yet for some people at some points, they might not have any of these behaviors and symptoms, yet they still have the disorder. So what's going on there? And so I try to provide a metaphysical picture of how we still manage to identify these diseases over time. Even given periods of relative asymptomaticity, and some dispositions is a way to help think about that. In short, chronic disease and mental disorders are dispositions towards the clinical manifestations that we actually use to identify them, to diagnose them. So that's the kind of first big part of the book, as I look at disease. In the second half, I look at evidence, particularly, what is evidence-based medicine's view of evidence? What does it mean to say that a clinical trial is providing evidence for medicine? What might be the limitations of this view In short, I argue that they that the view of the at least implicit view of evidence in evidence-based medicine is that evidence measures clinical outcomes. And so we can talk about the validity of that measurement, whether the measurement is biased, its precision, and so on. And while this works, this might do some of the work we need it to do. I think a broader concept of evidence, which allows for evidence to play different roles beyond just measuring outcomes, actually would suit medicine better. And so I try to pull from a theory that Nancy Cartwright has worked on in order to illustrate that alternative. I look at the problem of extrapolation, that problem that first got me interested in philosophy of medicine, existing work on the topic, and what parts of the problem have been somewhat neglected by both philosophers but also scientists. And that's namely the problem of, well, you know, once we've determined the kind of inferences we might need in order to extrapolate from studies, how possibly could we provide evidence for the assumptions or the premises in those inferences, where that evidence is strong enough to support the inference, but not so strong that upon having that evidence, we already really know the conclusion that we were trying to get to in the first place. So it's a kind of like circularity. How can we be in the Goldilocks zone where we have evidence that can allow us to extrapolate from a study, which will, I argue, and others have argued, necessarily involve some understanding of the causes that are at play, at least in those circumstances where we haven't sampled randomly from the target population. And yet, you know, causal or mechanistic understanding might also just get us what we want independently of extrapolating. If we know how treatments work, then we know that they work in certain contexts in which the kind of relevant factors are present. So that's a kind of circular or logical problem that I tackle in that chapter, focusing on like what kind of evidence or reasoning would get the job done and not just what assumptions would need to be satisfied. And then I turn to risk and what it means to lower risk or to predict risk in medicine, both at the level of populations and also individuals. And I defend a kind of Bayesian reinterpretation of probabilities in medicine, so that we're not talking about an individual patient's risk at all anymore, but we're just talking about a clinician's uncertainty about whether or not they're going to develop an outcome, or the extent to which an outcome would result in a probability that's lower, or sorry, the extent to which one treatment would result in a probability that's lower compared to an alternative treatment or no treatments. And this actually solves the kind of puzzle or riddle about how population data could be relevant to individuals when it really doesn't tell you that much about the unique features of that individual at all. It tells you more about the population in which they're situated, which might be quite heterogeneous. And the answer is just basically that these probabilities rather just reflect a clinician or the patient's uncertainty about whether they'll get an outcome, that our uncertainty can be influenced by, for instance, the fact that you don't know who in a population, to put it one way, this patient is, whether they're the kind of patient that would develop the outcome in the population, kind of patient who wouldn't develop the outcome. You can then just rely on the frequency of outcomes in that population in order to base your uncertainty on whether or not this particular member of that population will develop the outcome. And then, you know, finally, I turn to a topic that's been popular of late in philosophy of science, which is medical skepticism, and trying to develop a kind of skepticism about medical evidence and interventions that threads the fine needle between being overly nihilistic about the effectiveness of medical interventions today on the basis of well-described problems in medical research and being overly or naively optimistic about what therapies can do for us. I try to achieve this balancing act by relying on an account of what it is to have meta evidence or higher order evidence in medicine that captures these trends or problems in medical research that have been described. So the industry funding bias, publication bias, contradictions among studies, and other systematic problems or threats to medical research that have been empirically quantified by scientists, and uses that as itself a kind of higher order evidence in order to correct or adjust our confidence in medical interventions, and to appropriately calibrate our skepticism in the evidence and the interventions about which that evidence provides some information. So that's the full range of topics explored in the book.
Thank you so much for this.
Evidence. Yeah.
Excellent. No, this sounds very exciting. We can hope to see the book maybe in the next year or so, it sounds like, as things get getting on, working on it this year. Okay. It sounds like an excellent work. Two quick questions. One, so you mentioned your connection, especially with doing philosophy in, still associated with doing it, kind of doing medical research in some way, focusing on topics, and the topics that you discuss are certainly philosophical, and specifically philosophy of medicine. But, I interpret them as much, potentially relevant to clinicians and others who are reading about these kind of subjects in terms of how to think about not necessarily in directly practical terms, but just in the meaning of what they're doing or medical researchers. So how do you see this book as aligning with or connecting with the clinicians or medical researchers?
Well, the problems are mostly inspired by the philosophical problems which I explore in the book are inspired by medical problems that I encountered myself in medicine, or problems that I've read about in the medical literature, and that were quite popular topics in the literature for a time. And so rather than starting out with a problem in the philosophy of science literature, like, what kinds of explanations do we use in science? And is there just one kind of explanation or dominant kind of explanation, or are there many different kinds of explanation? Rather, it's kind of, well, how are doctors or medical scientists actually explaining things? Could we use some work in philosophy of science to better understand what they're doing? Maybe some work on theories in from philosophy of science, or rather, should we, adjust our thinking in philosophy of science to reflect mm-hmm. the particularities of medicine? Maybe the way that theories operate in medicine, or the way we think about causation in medicine, or whatever evidence in medicine. Maybe it's different enough that we kind of have to start somewhat from scratch. And so this kind of like medicine first mm-hmm. approach is definitely been a thread that's run through my work. There are kind of medical problems first, but then they also have a philosophical dimension or element. And so sometimes it could be that existing work in philosophy actually helps us to understand them better, work on dispositions. Right. Or work on from metaphysics, or work on higher order evidence from epistemology. Other times it might be a little bit less helpful, and rather we should be allowing work on medicine to maybe lead us to rethink classic problems in philosophy of science, rather than trying to fit problems of medicine to existing paradigms in philosophy of science. So I think there are genuinely philosophical problems, but they just are inspired by by topics or problems in medicine of particular relevance. I mean, it's not like a perennial problem in philosophy what a chronic disease is, or how we extrapolate from clinical trials. These aren't even perennial problems in medicine. I mean, the idea of extrapolating from a randomized controlled trial is not something that the ancients talked about, right? it's a very there are problems of the moment in medicine, problems of the day. Really bear cry out for some philosophical clarification. And those are the problems that really pique my interest. But there are different ways, of course, doing philosophy of science. It's perfectly fine, I think, to start from a literature in philosophy of science and then build on that literature. I've always been attracted to problems in which there isn't as much existing literature. And I think philosophy of medicine really offers that, because despite the importance of medicine in society, philosophy of medicine is actually a relatively small subdiscipline in philosophy. And so there are lots of unexplored questions and lots of territory to open up. And I think it's an exciting area for junior or senior philosophers to get involved in.
All right. Well, thank you so much. No, that's great. And one more question before we go. So I know I wanted to, we spoke at the beginning of this that you have, some time, a little bit separate from, perhaps, pretty separate from the book, that you're doing some work now. You're planning to head over to the NIH. Is that right? To be a visiting scholar? Is this to facilitate, or continue your work there, or what will you be up to at the NIH, going forward in the spring?
Yeah, so I'm going to be visiting the NIH specifically the Department of Bioethics for a few months in 2023 as a visiting scholar. And there are a couple motivations for this visit. One is that, you know, it's been a few years now since I finished medical school and I've been away from the clinic. You know, I worry a bit about losing touch with clinical research and clinical medicine. And so I wanted to work in an environment in which people are really, really heavily embedded in medicine. And bioethics is a field that's just like this. And a department like the Department of Bioethics at NIH especially. And so I wanted to, you know, just refresh my perspective a bit, so that I'm always at least partially grounded in what's going on in actual medicine. And I try to do that also by keeping connected to the School of Medicine at Pitt. But this is an opportunity to kind of do that. But also, one aspect of my thinking that it's been a common thread, but I've become, you know, very urgently interested in it as time has gone on, is how can we as philosophers of science have the most positive impact on science and society? And I'm not saying that this is the only way to think about the value of philosophy of science, but it's you know, particularly a question that interests me as somebody who still thinks of themselves as doing medical research and as being a kind of, like, you know, retired clinician, even though I only did medical school. But somebody, you know, this it's very a great importance for me. And so how can we have impact in philosophy of science? And I think there's some good models for how to think about this in philosophy of science now. There's this concept of philosophy in science, or more right. specifically, philosophy in biology and medicine, a kind of network and movement based out of the University of Bordeaux. And the idea there is, you know, you look at medical problems, you apply philosophical tools to solve them, often collaborating with health scientists or clinicians. You publish in venues that are visible to medicine or medical science. And hopefully you actually advance medical literature and contribute to solving medical, in this case, or scientific problems, and not just the philosophical literature and scientific philosophical literature and philosophical problems. But really, the discipline that's achieved this best in the area of medicine and medical philosophy is bioethics. Right. And so, you know, philosophy of medicine over the past couple of decades has kind of tried to define itself in contrast to bioethics. You know, we deal with philosophical problems in medicine, but we don't do bioethics. It's kind of a partial positive and partial negative characterization of the discipline itself. And this maybe was thought to be necessary because bioethics was so huge and the ethical problems of medicine received so much more attention that we didn't want these other problems that we were trying to explore to be swamped by that work.
Right.
So it was a very common way to characterize the discipline in writing and conference calls for abstracts and so on. Now, philosophy of medicine and bioethics used to be, I'd say, closer together. If you go back decades, where the main questions were about the nature of medicine, clinical judgment, whether medicine is a science and art or an art, the concepts of health and disease, disability. These were the problems, the questions that occupied a lot of so-called philosophers of medicine, and they happened to also be bioethicists. A lot of the early journals in philosophy of medicine were also journals in bioethics. And so really it was after the year 2000 that there was this kind of turn in philosophy of medicine to try to define itself as being something distinct, in order to create room to think about new questions that were maybe more connected to philosophy of science than to ethics. And this might have had some virtues, but I think it has resulted in philosophy of medicine being somewhat siloed from bioethics, ironically. Yeah. Siloed maybe from some of the ethical or political questions that are relevant to medicine, but also just siloed from this institution, bioethics, that's been very successful at having an impact on medical research and practice. You know, if you want a model of an area where there is genuine philosophical work going on, and they've actually had an influence on society and science, bioethics is a great model of that. So if we want, as philosophers of medicine, to have an impact on you know, society and science and medicine, then the bioethics offers us both a model, but also a door, an open door, perhaps. And so reintegrating these two areas, philosophy of medicine and bioethics, I think is a growing interest of mine. And so that's also partly the motivation for this is to try to draw some of these connections and build some of these bridges between philosophy of science and medicine on the one hand and bioethics on the other hand.
I appreciate that. No, that's really interesting to think about, especially just the challenges of connecting. I've generally heard from, on the one hand, philosophers who have interest in philosophy of medicine. They feel like that from what I hear them saying, they don't want to be pinned down to just focus on particular questions in bioethics, or often it comes down to like supervising or teaching in a particular aspect of bioethics. So if you're at a university and you're associating with or wanting to teach a course or do research in something, but you have these other issues or questions with medical epistemology or in your case evidence-based medicine, and it's not quite a bioethics bent. So that's really interesting to hear about the connection. Is there something like, let's say at the one of the big bioethics conference, the American Society for Bioethics and Humanities, is there a presence of philosophers of medicine who still attend that conference, or is that, are they separate in that regard?
Yeah, so I think the answer is yes. There is a philosophy of medicine, I'm not sure if it's called a section or an interest group within the American Society for Bioethics. And so at the conference, they'll often have a session, and I presented at this. And of course, probably more than that, there are philosophers of medicine at bioethics conferences who are there not really as philosophers of medicine per se, but as bioethicists, because they also do research in bioethics. Or at least that's the way you might describe the situation if you buy into this sharp distinction between philosophy of medicine and bioethics. You see what I'm saying? So they might be there, but they're presenting bioethics work. And if you think that philosophy of medicine is not bioethics, then they might do philosophy of medicine in their other work, but they're there presenting bioethics work. So there is some presence, I think, but it's not massive from my own experience, my understanding. And so this is a question for the field, I think, going forward, is what should be the relationship between philosophy of medicine and bioethics? And then, bioethics, of course, has its own unique features. It's not just philosophical ethics applied to medicine, is it? Clinicians are involved. Legal scholars are involved in the discipline. Empirical scientists are involved. It's an interdisciplinary field. That's one way of maybe potentially, as philosophers of science, having an influence is through interdisciplinary work or collaborating with other kinds of scholars. But I think as I kind of explore the relationship between these two areas, philosophy of medicine and bioethics, are there lessons to be learned more broadly in philosophy of science about how it is that certain disciplines have been successful at having what I think is a positive impact on science and practice? What are some of the challenges that confront us there? And maybe even the more metaphilosophical and fundamental question that we should be asking first is, what is the point of philosophy of science? Should it concern itself with actual science and practice? Is it excusable to not do that? What is its role and relevance? And will it continue to survive in an increasingly STEM focused academic environment? If it's not felt to be relevant to the world around it. Now, I do think actually that philosophy of science is very relevant to the world, and there's lots of philosophers of science who are demonstrating that. So this is really more about what are the different models for doing that, or the ways of thinking about doing that institutionally, intellectually, what are the different ways of achieving this? And so maybe bioethics is one kind of exemplar for how to go about thinking about it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I hadn't made the connection. I mean, I just have known that bioethics is always this connection, but as thinking about it as a model or vehicle for, especially if you're doing kind of work that you hope to have an impact in the particular science or in the particular field in which you're doing the philosophy, it's really good. I can't think of another branch of philosophy. There might be, but such a large, something like bioethics, where you see such a large collection of both scientists and philosophers getting together, and the journals themselves, the scientists and the clinicians or practitioners or the researchers really taking an interest, and because they have the interest in these questions, for maybe not to the same degree, but there isn't institutionally, organizationally, there's not something that is it's generally like niche practitioners that kind of come out to kind of join in. So yeah, I could definitely see something where people, I don't know how, I guess I'd have to look into the history of bioethics as a discipline, as a field, and see like how this branch ended up breaking off and from medicine proper, or maybe not. That's probably the wrong way to think about it, but I don't know. I'm just kind of assuming, like, how did it come to be? Perhaps you know a little bit about that, but yeah. So anyway, you might just be reiterating, because this kind of got into some problems related to philosophy of science, but so feel free to just say just what I was talking about. But what do you take to, as a last question, what do you take to be the greatest challenge facing philosophy of science today?
Well, I actually was going to say that it's this very problem is trying to understand the point of the discipline and its relevance to society and the broader world. You know, there are constant anxieties around about the sustainability of the field, about job security and these kinds of elements. You might have worries about, there might be side effects. We might have genuine concerns if philosophy of science becomes more integrated with science. We might lose the kind of independence that we have if we're in our own departments, the independence of thought, the independence of being able to say what we want, to criticize science from a distance without mm-hmm. Having to live with those same colleagues in the same department, and maybe even risk offending the wrong people, the wrong bosses. So there might be some intellectual and institutional reasons why some separateness is actually quite beneficial. We might if you're too close to a discipline, maybe the assumptions of that discipline become invisible to you. And maybe you start to think too much like the people in that discipline. So actually maybe a kind of separateness is also valuable. So having said that, I think, we need to ask ourselves, how can philosophy of science, in a sense, stay in touch with science and society? I mean, we should also consider the possibility that there are some virtues of a kind of detachment. And so that's why I think that we just have to think in terms of different models for doing this. There might not be just one model that we should use. Maybe we need lots of different models, so that collectively, epistemically, it will be the best way to make progress in philosophy and in science.
Thank you. And that's something, so a lot of folks have talked about models for integration or models for connecting, but I would love to see a model, a clearer model of detachment. Not that necessarily I'm advocating for one, but just one that kicks in mind the idea that the former model of detachment, or, the way in which things were done, people were dissatisfied with, or perhaps, or the reason there is for the reasons that other folks have wanted to be more engaged, or that we see this in practice, these in practice approaches. But is there something to be said for like a new model of detachment, or a new model of separation, siloing, that we don't just see, like we talk about disciplinary silos is a bad thing sometimes, and I think it doesn't necessarily have to be, just for the reasons that you suggested. So right. that would be interesting to think. So anyway, we've gone way too long. I mean, a lot, just long. I've really enjoyed our talk. Thank you, Dr. Fuller, John, for joining us and sharing about your book. We're very excited to see its release pending. And but anyway, yeah, have a good rest of your Wednesday here in Pittsburgh. And yeah, I'll be talking and seeing you soon.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. Take care. Have a good one.